forgotten lore.
Got it.
Just like that.
Did you have to switch your orientation to locked?
I locked it because, yeah, I have it open in a Google Doc and I keep whipping my phone around. So, yeah. You know, sometimes I find with Google Docs, especially when we have like images and lots of words, if it flips the orientation too much, it just crashes. It like I just fucking can't and it just crashes. Yeah,
usually it's a good program, but sometimes not so much.
You know what? We all crash sometimes.
That's right. Yeah. So anyways, welcome to the show. This is Forgotten Lore. I'm Kevin.
I'm Riley.
And I'm Ainsley.
And today on the show, we are going to be watching season 4 of The Crown. No, that is the wrong tab. Today on the show, we are going to be wrapping up our invasion series with part 3. On the last episode, we discovered that Hannah, Weatherlight's navigator, and Gerard's Lady Love had been stricken with a mysterious Phyrexian wasting disease, and that Orym had been unable to remedy. We also caught up with the leader of the Skyshroud Elves, Elidomri, who had survived his trip from Wrath at the end of Nemesis and was now leading a ragtag group of Dominarians against the invaders.
Okay, I'm going to get him. We got to get the cat out of here. He's being bad.
He is being
get
bad.
Him.
Every other day of the week, every other time.
Couldn't care less about the balloon.
Couldn't care less about the balloon. You start recording, it's like, wow, oh, balloon.
Yeah.
That's... Yeah, whenever I work from home, Miri, anytime I go on to like a Teams meeting.
As soon as you start a meeting?
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, she's like, hi.
She's like, you talking?
You've been quiet all day.
You talking to me? Yeah.
So, finally, we traveled to Zalfir and Shiv, where Teferi, much to Urza, Baron, and the Dragon Nation's chagrin, had just phased most of the continent out of existence in order to save his and Joyra's people from the invasion.
I like a good chagrin. I don't think we use chagrin enough.
I think you're right about that. Right. I think you're right. So while all that was going on, the Metathran assault on Koilos had begun. Tabo Tavik watched from her perch above the caves as Thaddeus and Agnet led their thousands of Metathran to surround the Phyrexian army. The Phyrexians surrounded a series of trenches that surrounded the plateau that was essentially the cave's entrance. From it, Phyrexian troopers, Bloodstocks, and Scuta continued to emerge and bolster the already massive force filling the desert impression below the Metathran army. Thaddeus and Agnate had split their forces in half, one group surrounded from the north and the other the south. The classic pincer assault, and for some reason, Thaddeus and Agnate gave up the high ground and advanced on the Phyrexian army. And as Star Wars taught us, never give up the high ground.
Oh, no.
Each of the Metathran generals was followed by 40,000 more Metathran as the Phyrexians, but before they could reach them, giant worms emerged from beneath the sand, the same ones that had dug the trenches surrounding the caves.
Hey, look, it's Heidi Klum.
I don't get that. I know who she is, but I don't. Is she a worm?
She was the one who dressed up as the worm for Halloween.
Oh, that was her.
That was Heidi Klum.
Oh, yeah. That was gross. Yeah. Okay, they had so the worms had black hides and jutted hairs as stout and sharp as daggers, with huge mouths formed of three triangular lips. And if you want to look up what these things look like, it's the card trench worms. Those lips could turn chunks of rock to sand, so you can imagine what they would do to a Metathran.
Oh, boy.
There were 6 in total, and Thaddeus and Agnate had a hell of a time dealing with them, but despite their casualties, they slayed all 6 while the Phyrexian army watched.
Slay, girl!
Oh, yeah, gotta slay. With that obstacle taken care of, they advanced on the Phyrexian line, which they finally saw movement on, but not from the troops. Rather, small artifact creatures scurried along the sand to meet the Metathran charge. Small centipede-looking creatures, about 3 feet long.
Yeah, a little bit of a widow's peak.
That's not a widow's peak. That's a receding hairline.
Okay, sorry.
The creatures were designed to jump at their targets' mouths, force themselves inside their victim's body, and replace their victim's spine with themselves.
I don't like that. No, I don't like
that's
it.
That's always...
Get out of my mouth. I don't like that.
The victim would die and be reanimated under Tabo Tavik's control. The very same technology the crew of Weatherlight witnessed in I don't know if it was part one or two, but that's what they did to the merfolk, if you guys remember. This meant that the Metathran's new target wasn't the Phyrexian line, it was their zombified brethren. Fortunately, Urza had designed them to be unyielding, and they eventually dispatched the Metathran zombies, as well as the remaining centipede spines.
Ooh.
That's what my colleagues say when I say I'm going to go to the bathroom. I usually get a nope.
That's funny. Yeah.
So with that, each side of the Metathran pincer met their Phyrexian foes. Their goal was simple, close the portal permanently. So, while Agnet's forces were stalled out fighting Phyrexians, Thaddeus and 1,000 or so of his best warriors slowly advanced on the caves. This whole part of the novel is incredibly graphic in terms of Metathran cutting and tearing apart disgusting bug-like Phyrexians. So, if that's something that you're into, you should read the book for yourself. But I'm really not going to get into it because I don't like bugs.
He's not a bug man.
No, I'm not a bug man. Did not enjoy this part of the book. But Thaddeus eventually fought his way through the Phyrexian horde and arrived at the cave entrance. But it turns out it had been a ruse. Tabo had allowed Thaddeus to reach the caves because she wanted to capture him, as well as Agnet, as trophy specimens to take back to the fourth sphere of Phyrexia. Unaware, Thaddeus... and what was left of his force, only 20 by that point, advanced into the caves. They planned to use grenades to collapse the portal cave and destroy the mirror pedestal holding the portal open. But like I said, it was a trap.
It's a trap!
We all did that.
It's ruined a generation. As the Metathran advanced, they were slowly whittled away until only Thaddeus remained, and he was unfortunately captured. By
poor
Tabo
Thaddeus.
Tabic. No kidding. Yeah, it's like, oh, don't get me with
your
legs.
It's like, oh, I'm a fatty.
Oh, and he's already got, she's getting him and he's chained up. It's a little BDSM.
Is that a lady?
That's Tabo. All
right.
Yeah, she's a lady.
She's got a little mustache. I'm nothing wrong with that.
Well, she's got, it's like she has these lines on the side of her face that kind of like separate her mouth so you can open it more. But yeah, this is kind of drawn funny. Yeah, it's not really a mustache. But yeah, she's a lady.
I mean, ladies can have a mustache.
She's a lady. They can. You know what? They can.
They can, and they do.
Hashtag not all mustaches.
What are you saying?
So the Metathran general was knocked unconscious by the spider woman, and when he next awoke, he was on an operating table.
Oh, God.
He'd been splayed open from stem to sternum, much the same way Yawgmoth had dissected the planeswalker Dyfed so many millennia earlier. Unlike Dyfed, though, Thaddeus had been fastened to the table and retained his faculties while Tabo Tavik studied him. And if you want to know more about Dyfed, go back and listen to our series on the Thran novel, because we get that's where she's from. So by that point, Agnate had lost the neural connection he shared with his twin. That, coupled with the fact that half their army had been killed while the Phyrexian numbers only grew, caused him to withdraw to the Metathran staging camp in the Defile. The Battle of Koilos wasn't over, but the Metathran would need reinforcements if they hoped to stage another attack on the Portal Cave. Meaning that we'll have to travel to Urborg, the fetid, swampy, ancestral home of the, at the time, Evankar of Wrath, Krovax, and the next target of the invasion.
Swampy!
Oh yeah, it stinks too.
Stinky and swampy.
After his trip to Shiv, Baron had returned to the battle in Keld, and by that point, Urza had convinced Baron that it was a losing battle and urged him to travel to Urborg with the Keldons to defend it. Baron was also joined by Sarens, the elves of Yavimea, and Rami Darigaz's Dragon Nation. Hashtag Dragon Nation.
Oh my god, that's so funny.
So they traveled to Urborg, and they actually held their own against the Phyrexian forces pretty well. But as is so often the case, the Phyrexians threw almost insurmountable numbers at the Keldons. But just when the tide was beginning to turn in the Phyrexians' favor, the ghouls of Urborg began to rise from the swamp to consume Phyrexians.
Swampy.
Baron gazed across the battlefield to see a lich throw him a wink.
What?
If nothing else, the invasion created some strange alliances.
What is happening?
I'm just trying to speed through things here. Oh, God.
Is Baron getting seduced?
No, it's just like a hey, buddy, like we're on the same, hey, the enemy of my enemy, right? Wink. And we're going to get these Phyrexians, eat them, and then turn them into liches.
Okay, thanks for clarifying.
Yeah, yeah. Wink.
Do liches have eyelids?
Some of them do. Yeah.
The ones that wink do.
Because you have like a lich, like, because the thing, a lich is a, like, an undead creature who's held on to their personality and memories. Whereas I think a zombie is like just
a shell.
Roving, yeah, monster without any thoughts. So when we use the term lich, you know, they can wink. They understand the nuance of a wink, but a zombie is just like,
So if a zombie winks at you, it doesn't mean you have an alliance with them.
Yeah, that's exactly. You got it. So.
Glad we cleared that up.
By that point, Orym had dissected the four Phyrexians she'd caught on Wrath and synthesized a vaccine to the plague killing Hannah. Not only would it protect those yet infected, it would also halt the spread of the disease. Fortunately, she'd also discovered that Hannah's condition was too advanced for her serum to have any effect.
Yeah, I had a feeling that was going to happen.
Well, you guys should have called it, because now you just sound like...
I just imagine...
just hopped on the Hannah dying bandwagon.
Yeah, yeah, I just imagine, like, the camera zooms out and Urza's still standing there not doing anything.
Yeah, he's just like, whew, I'm surprised
sounds
by
rough.
This.
Yeah,
So having said that, every member of Weatherlight's crew was dosed, including the warrior refugees from the Benelish prison. Sailing over Llanowar, Weatherlight watched as the plague spread faster than the spiders could stop it. So Orym suggested they administer her serum to the forest itself. So Weatherlight traveled beneath the canopy and moored in the ruined elven palace to investigate. Gerard, Cissé, and Tongarth were the only ones to leave Weatherlight. They took what serum they could carry, found the stairs leading beneath the palace, and began their descent. By that point, Lin Sivi had rejoined Elidamri, and the elven refugees had reached the very bottom of the subterranean staircase. They weren't sure how long they would be able to survive or what their next move would be, and that's when Multani arrived to warn Elidamri. The following exchange was telepathic, as Multani didn't want to cause a panic.
Good.
Wish we all had that ability.
The palace is destroyed with all who remained above. This is despite the ceaseless labors of giant spiders to contain the contagion. Throughout the forest, death is rampant.
This is not news. We knew all above was destroyed by the bombs.
It is worse. The first ship has landed in the ruins of... what is it? Staprian?
Yeah.
Staprian. Okay. The first ship has landed in the ruins of Staprian Palace. The smell of oil blood pervades the ship and its crew. They descend within the palace tree, following the routes that led you here. You must take a war party up to battle them.
Yes.
You are their savior now. You must save them.
I was a warrior before, and I would gladly fight these monsters again.
But the ones Multani sensed were Gerard, Cissé, and Tongarth, and the ship was Weatherlight. They stunk of Phyrexian oil because of Orym's serum.
Stinky.
Elidamri still... Elidamri still gathered a war party and ascended the stairs to meet his former allies. And when they met, they explained to each other everything they'd been through since they last met. So we're just going to fast forward through that.
This happened and this happened and that happened and this happened.
Gerard also reunited with his former master, Multani, the forest spirit who had taught Morrow's sorcery to Gerard in his youth, and each of them had feared the other dead since they last saw one another. So that's nice.
Like, hey, you're not dead!
Although, with Multani teaching Morrow's sorcery to Gerard, I don't think he's ever
used
any quote-unquote Morrow sorcery, so I'm not sure he was the best student.
I'm a tree now.
He got turned into a tree. Anyway, they got to work dosing the elven refugees with Orym's serum, and something else happened. While Elidamri was deep beneath Llanowar with the refugees, he connected to the heart of the forest, and somehow that connection began to heal it from within.
Aww.
Magic, I think. Probably. Either way, where once rot and death filled the treetops, now music and life reigned, kind of like the end of Return of the Jedi.
Let's see how many Star Wars jokes you can get in here.
Star Wars references galore.
So, Llanowar had still been horribly scarred by the Phyrexian plague, but it had indeed become another Dominarian victory in the invasion. But all that was at odds with Hanna's ever-worsening condition. With no other option, Gerard and Orym asked Multani and Elidamri to heal her, hoping for the best. Elidamri suggested they take her to the heart of Llanowar, claiming that if he had the power to heal her, he would. Elidamri chose the 10 that believed most in him to accompany him, and Gerard did the same. While Multani carried the skeleton of a woman that Hanna had become, Lin Sivi was first in Elidamri's contingent, and the rest were nameless elves. Gerard, who had nodded numbly at the elf's suggestion, heard a solemn rumble at his side. It was Tongarth.
I would be honored to be included in the company.
Good Tongarth voice. I like that. Once, the Minotaur had considered Gerard a spoiled, selfish, and angry young man. Somewhere along the line, the bullman's opinion had changed. Perhaps, he thought, because Gerard had changed. But I like to think that war always reveals the true nature of those who fight, and Gerard and Tongarth really weren't so different.
We're not so different, you and I.
I'm kind of a bull.
Yeah. I'm a man. You got to, he's could, a bull man.
Could you get some gel and make horns with your hair?
Some dippity do.
Oh, you could do anything with dippity do.
Oh man, you could.
My goodness, ruined a generation.
Oh yeah, it did.
Sisse volunteered next, then Squee, and of course Orym. Then Karn emerged from the bowels of Weatherlight to join them for their descent.
This seems has too much production. All the people are going. I don't like where this is headed. I'm just throwing it out there.
Okay. All right. Riley, what do you think?
I'm just along for the ride.
He's just honored to be included in the company.
So when the 20-odd group reached the very bottom of the palace tree and found themselves in what was known as the Dreaming Caves, Weatherlight's command crew shared stories of their travels, of Hanna steering the ship past wrathy slivers, of her heroism inside the stronghold, of her encyclopedic understanding of Weatherlight, of her pinpoint navigation, her shy wit, her laughter. They spoke of courage, strength, and wisdom, not illness and death.
She's gonna fucking die.
They probably talked about also like how good looking she was too.
Beautiful.
Yeah. Once they finished, Elidamri lifted his lantern so that the light reached out across the cavern and splashed over a figure below. Multani had formed himself into a great woody altar, cradling Hanna, and it was clear to all that she was no better off since entering the cavern.
Is Gerard there?
Yeah, okay. He's there. Elidamri approached Gerard and asked him to tell him about Hanna so that he would have a clear picture of her in his mind. Gerard went on to tell him all the times Hanna had saved their lives since. Elidamri used his connection to the cave and the information Gerard fed him to plant the images he created into the mind of everyone present. The image of Hanna as she had been. Then Elidamri beckoned Gerard to gaze at the woman Multani cradled.
Because Gerard and Hanna are like in love, right? Like,
yeah, they're an item.
Okay. I just think it's cute because it's like, okay, tell me about her. And he's like, I'm going to tell you about all the times she saved our lives. It's like, isn't she like your life partner? Like, that's what you're going to talk about? But you know what?
J. Robert King.
J. Robert King. He might not be a romance writer, and that's okay.
Yeah, he might be like Stephen King, who's not great at romance.
Yeah, you know what? Sometimes you're not. Like, I like to write romance. I would suck at like sci-fi battle shit.
Yeah. All right. So Hanna was as she had been, but no amount, like when they looked at her, but no amount of the group's belief that she was healed could heal her. Hanna was so near death that she wasn't conscious enough to know what was happening, nor was she conscious enough to believe what they all believed. Because of that, if they moved her from the altar, she would appear as she truly was, skeletal and dying. At that point, Gerard pretty much had a breakdown, and he, just like Hanna, had to be carried back to Weatherlight.
Oh, okay. Yeah. He's sad now.
He's having a tough time.
Tongarth, carry me.
Nice. Yeah, after he did his hair all bull-like. Yeah, yeah. For sure. So Gerard had regained his composure by the time they got back to the ship, and Multani placed Hannah back in Weatherlight's sick bay, where Gerard joined her. And he held her skeletal hand and promised her that if the Phyrexian plague was the end of her...
I will be my own plague. I will rot them away. I've had enough of portal wars and serums. I want a fight. A real one. I want teeth against knuckles and broken noses and knives and eyes.
It's dark. The blind seer spoke, surprising Gerard.
I have a fight for you. Not I, but Dominaria. You have lost Benalia and saved Llanowar. Now there is Koilos.
Koilos? A hole in the desert?
More than that. At Koilos, the Phyrexians were first driven from the world. At Koilos, they first returned in the time of Urza. Now it is their only land portal. If that hole in the desert is lost, all is lost.
Gerard gazed at Hannah and said,
All is lost.
Grief can wait. Koilos cannot. The Metathran have been beaten back. One of their commanders is captured and near death. They need you and your ship. They need the Benelish air fleet, the prison brigade, elf shock troops, and their leader, Elidamri.
He has a nation to rebuild. He won't go.
He will go. Saviors are not builders. He and his elite warriors will go. Multani, too, will go.
Multani!
He was present for the birth of this living ship. He provided her hull from the heart of Yavimaya. He goes with us in the very wood of Weatherlight. Koilos is your fight, Gerard.
Of course, it's a fight Hannah would approve. And besides, at Koilos, there are plenty of Phyrexians to kill.
Yeah, stick some knives in their eyes and whatnot.
Oh yeah.
Knives out.
And just like that, Weatherlight, her crew, Elidamri, and his warriors traveled to Koilos to reinforce the Metathran. When Weatherlight first topped the ridge of sand above the plains of Koilos, they were met with miles of Phyrexians, and they did what they did best. Settled into an attack formation with their fleet and killed as many as they could. Eventually, though, Weatherlight was forced to land after one of her airfoils was damaged enough to affect her maneuverability. The Blind Seer suggested they land near the Metathran camp to rendezvous and repair. Weatherlight and her crew were met with a far warmer welcome from Agnate and the Metathran due to Urza's presence. He'd appeared just as Weatherlight and the Benelish flotilla arrived and assured Agnate that they were allies. When Agnate questioned the planeswalker, Urza said simply,
Coalition forces, airships, a Benelish army, an elf strike force, and a replacement for Thaddeus.
So, can you remind me who Agnate is again?
He's the other, so there are like two Metathran generals. He's one of them. The other one is being like dissected by Sabo Tavik at this point. So he's like the only Metathran general left. He's like a big blue guy.
Big blue guy, okay.
That's all you needed to say was big blue guy.
There will never be a replacement for Thaddeus.
We will see.
Urza explained that Elidamri was Thaddeus's replacement. It's like, look, dude, it's just, you're going to have to deal with it, okay? Agnate had been engineered to lead half the Metathran army. He needed a counterpart, and Urza had deemed the elf capable of the task, but he would have to pass a test first. No Metathran would follow the elf unless he proved himself against Agnate. A duel, but not to the death. Whoever drew first blood won. If it was Agnate, he would have to lead the army alone. But if Elidamri prevailed, he would take on the role of Thaddeus. But Agnate was right. He could not be replaced. So, they dueled while the coalition forces watched, their bodies forming a crude arena for the two master warriors. The ironic part being that neither would exist were it not for Yawgmoth's oppression.
Oh man, it's like the gift of the Magi.
It's like Voldemort, right?
Neither can live while the other survives.
Self-fulfilling prophecy, baby. Anyway, while the crowd watched and cheered for their respective champion, a voice broke through the cacophony. It was the Blind Seer speaking to Gerard. He told him that Hannah was awake and was asking for him. Turns out she's fine.
No.
No, I'll cut that. Gerard rushed to Weatherlight and found her in Orym's sickbay, followed by the old man. When he found her, she seemed almost like her old self, almost healed. But in truth, the blind seer, who you've probably guessed by this point was Urza, had used his powers to bring Hannah back to life so that she and Gerard could say goodbye. So the blind seer is Urza, in case you didn't know.
Okay.
Spoilers.
Riley probably knew. Yeah. That was like the first Urza card we ever got in the actual like card game was the blind seer from this set.
Oh yeah, I didn't know because I don't play.
No, that's why you're good.
Come on.
I can be like, what?
So it only lasted seconds. She said she loved him. She said she believed in him. She said goodbye to him. Then she died in his arms, her final breath leaving her in a long, sweet sigh. R.I.P. Hannah. Yeah. So at that moment, Urza questioned his power. Planeswalkers could heal most diseases with a thought, but not Phyrexian plagues. He felt regret that he hadn't studied disease processes instead of artifice. But he knew that his machines would save millions of lives and could not be reasonably exchanged for a single one. Even so, Hannah had anchored Gerard. Without her, he would be a different man, perhaps a lesser man. Urza just hoped that Gerard would still be sufficient for his role in all this. He also thought of Baron and decided to wait until the mage had won the Battle of Urborg before telling him his estranged daughter was dead.
That's a good idea.
Yeah, probably. Probably a good idea. Just then, an ovation roared from outside the ship, and a Benelish prison warrior came to the door of the sickbay. Excited, he let all inside know that Elidomri had bested Agnate with a cut to the Metathran's bicep. Elidomri would lead the other half of the Metathran army, but they would need more than that to have a chance at closing the portal. That's where the next stage of Urza's plan came into play.
Coming into play. It's gonna come into play. It's gonna play out somehow. On the next stage. Hey.
And that's where we'll pick back up. So, the Planeswalker had designed and built legions of artifacts to fight Phyrexia. The crowning achievement of his labors being Weatherlight. But as we've seen time and again, the Skyship couldn't push back Yawgmoth's armies on her own. So, in much the same vein as Weatherlight, Urza designed and built 9 gargantuan artifact creatures equipped with a vast arsenal of weaponry. Ares of Falcon engines, wrist-mounted rocket launchers, mana cannons, as well as colossal hands and feet capable of crushing hundreds of Phyrexians at a time. And those are just a few examples of what these machines had at their disposal. because their pilot was the real weapon. Urza had designed each of them around being piloted and powered by a planeswalker. 9 planeswalkers that he'd chosen very carefully. Once piloted, the machines would begin to emulate that walker's characteristics and powers. Urza had built them to act as extensions of the planeswalker's power, and he'd named them the Titans with that in mind. By that point, Urza had traveled back to Talaria to make the final adjustments to the 9 Titans. With that done, he gathered his walkers. And I was this part of the novel I thought would be like, if they ever did this in a movie, it would be a great like montage scene where it's just like Urza like collecting his guys. So he first planeswalked to the Minotaur homeland to find the planeswalker Taser and his daughter Daria, who was also a planeswalker, which made me wonder how often planeswalkers come from the same family. Anyway, Urza had not originally chosen Daria as one of his 9, but with Teferi phased out with Shiv, he needed a replacement. Then the 3 of them traveled to Llanowar to conscript Freylies.
Is that Daria?
No, it's Freylies. I don't have a picture of Daria.
La 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 la.
Oh, yeah. Great show. They found the half-elf resting in the inner sanctum of the forest, and again, she was entertaining a second planeswalker. Her name was Christina of the Woods, and Urza had not originally chosen her as one of his 9, but Freylies convinced the ancient planeswalker to take Christina instead of a walker known as Percher. Apparently, he was quite the lunatic and too insane to be trusted with such an important task.
Well, yeah, then don't fucking take him. He's a cuckoo banana. It's like, Ursa's, I don't know. I'd rather take him than this lady over here. Yeah.
Well, you know how they get.
Well, I mean, it kind of lines up with Ursa's mentality. It's like, oh, yeah, I'll take the limit.
Yeah, he's a little nuts, definitely. With 5 of his 9 assembled, Ursa traveled to a pirate ship sailing under the Glimmer Moon. There, they found the planeswalker Bo Levar, the cigar smuggler.
Ooh.
In truth, he's got a little cigar in his mouth. In truth, he was an interplanar merchant, and he was more than happy to be called to defend Dominaria. He's taking this guy, but not the lunatic. Like, what are we doing here?
I love these B planeswalkers.
I know, these fucking B listers. Yeah, we're just like, dude, where did you find these guys? Next, the group traveled to a great hidden library where they found the planeswalker known as Commodore Guff.
Oh my god, this guy. Okay, he has a monocle. He has like flaming orange hair and a big old white beard that comes to 2 points.
You just cut the middle. That's all you do. You just like, shoot.
Still. And Commodore Guff. He's wearing like a cape and he's like doing this little power thing and he has his mouth open and his eyes closed and he's like, I got the power.
My beard kind of does that. Like I have like a part here where like not a lot of hair grows and I get these 2 like gross red points. My beard is disgusting.
I'm glad you've never had one in the 10 years we've been together.
Yeah. Well, it hasn't been that long yet. Please don't.
Do we have cards of these guys? Like I've never.
Well, these guys, this artwork comes from. These are either from Invasion or from Planeshift, but it's like Planeswalker's Mischief, Planeswalker's Wrath. There's a whole. They're enchantments, and there's one for each color.
Okay.
And that's where these artwork comes from. But to me, they kind of seem like the precursors of actual Planeswalker cards because they like, had abilities, but you had to pay mana.
Okay, interesting.
To use them. But yeah, each one is sort of like Commodore Guff, I think it's like Planeswalker's Mirth. But yeah, there's one for almost all of these guys. I mean, there's only 5 and like these are like 9, but if you search like Planeswalkers on Scryfall, you'd find these cards. But yeah, I feel like they're Planeshift, not Invasion, but regardless. So Ursa simply said, it's time. And the group of walkers, including Guff, disappeared from the library and reappeared in Sarpedia. There they found the draconic human planeswalker, Tevish Zat.
Hell yeah.
That made 8, and the rest of the walkers wondered who the 9th was. Ursa explained that it was the catfolk planeswalker, Lord Windgrace.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, he's a cat boy.
Yes. Yeah.
At that point, though, Windgrace was assisting Baron with the Battle of Urborg. Ursa would send for him when the battle was won.
Swampy.
It's fetid. Yeah. It's like when your basement floods and it's like fetid. The nearly 9 assembled. Ursa planeswalked them to the Phyrexian rift that still existed on Talaria. Crick's former pocket Phyrexia and Urza's current fast time laboratory. It was where he'd built and stored the Titans in secret.
Phyrexia pocket.
Crick life. Like
Polly pocket.
As the planeswalkers inspected their new rigs, Ursa explained that they would use the Titans to mount an attack on Phyrexia, much the same way Ursa had with his dragon engine millennia earlier. Before they could do that, though, they needed to assist the coalition forces gathered at Koilos. That's when Daria announced that it would take months to learn to use the Titans. She was right, but they had months, 2 to be exact. And here comes another montage scene.
Oh, good. I can see it in my mind's eye.
The coalition forces at Koilos planned another attack on the portal cave in 2 weeks of normal time, which was 2 months inside the Phyrexian Rift. And over the next 2 weeks, the Battle of Urborg raged on. Baron's forces were joined by Saren Angels, Metathran soldiers, Elven Shock troops, and of course, Lord Windgrace's Panther Boys. That's with a Z.
Panther Boys!
Boys! Actually,
it's like that place in Winnipeg called Carboys.
Oh, yeah. Me? Yeah. Actually, Violet's been calling me Pizza Boy, but she does like the boy.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
She's also been calling you a grub, which I think is from Bluey.
Yeah, she's like, put me down, you big grub.
You big grub? Okay, that's funny.
But she also calls me like Papa Boy. No. She's doing the boy.
Oh, my God.
Or she calls me Baby Papa, which she thinks is really funny.
She thinks it's that's like hysterical.
Calling an adult a baby, she thinks is so funny.
Like, that's pretty funny.
Like it's the sickest burn.
Yeah, she's like, I got you, bitch.
I mean, she's she's onto something.
Yeah. One time she was calling you Papa Baby Mama, and she thought it was hysterical.
She also just, if it's like, if she switches the genders, she also thinks it's really hilarious.
Yeah.
She's like, I got you.
Like, it's like, honey, don't worry. We'll teach you to be more woke.
It's almost like it's like inborn. Right, you know, that kind of like making fun of thing, but we'll teach her, it's all good. So all of those everything they threw at Urborg wasn't enough. The Phyrexians were too many and too vicious. They slew the Keldons and Metathran to a man. They drove Sarens and elves and panther warriors from the isle. When the cost of battle mounted, Urza himself had summoned Rami Darigaz and the Dragon Nations to fight.
Rami Darigaz!
I would love just that. Just Rami Darigaz all in bold on a t-shirt.
Yeah.
I would get so many people being like, what the fuck is that?
Yeah. Or even like a shirt where it had like a built-in like, hello, my name is. And it was like,
Rami Darigaz. But none of that was enough. Eventually, only Baron remained. As he surveyed the carnage, he knew he would need further reinforcements, so he teleported to Urza. The Mage Master could find the Planeswalker anywhere, but to his surprise, Urza wasn't on Talaria. So Urza was at Koilos, in a secret bunker 1,000 feet beneath the desert bedrock. The bunker was 2,000 feet long and 100 feet wide, and in it were the Titan engines. Doesn't say how big this high the ceiling was, though. I noticed that in the book.
Probably big enough,
yeah. So when Baron arrived to ask why he wasn't on Talaria, Urza explained that the Phyrexians had found the island and attacked it. It was due to the plane's shifting of so many powerful walkers that alerted the enemy to the island's location. Urza and the other walkers had little time to escape with the Titan engines, and the island now belonged to Phyrexia, another casualty of war. Urza asked if the battle in Urborg was over, and Baron explained the state of things. He asked for reinforcements and said that if he didn't receive them, Urborg was lost.
And Urborg is lost.
So that's it? A month ago, Urborg had to be saved at all costs, and now you lose it with a shrug?
Riley.
It is a strategically important site, second only to Koilos, but it is second to Koilos. If Urborg cannot be held without reinforcements, then Urborg is lost and swampy.
Urza went on to explain the final stages of the invasion, or at least his plans for them, to Baron. With his role in the fight for Urborg complete, Baron set out to find his daughter, but Urza stopped him, telling him she was no longer aboard Weatherlight.
What do you mean?
Hannah died 2 weeks ago.
What? What did you say?
Plague overwhelmed her. There was nothing anyone could do.
The Mage Master's face became a sickly white, and he steadied himself on Urza's work table.
I could have held her hand. I could have stroked her hair. Why didn't you summon me?
Urborg had to be saved.
Don't say that! Don't for one moment say that! Of course you didn't call me. Your work has always been the most important thing. Of course I wasn't there when my daughter died. I wasn't there when she lived. You stole her from me. And the worst part is that I let you steal her from me. Where is she?
Gerard buried her. She lies in the sands of Koilos.
She wouldn't have wanted that. This desert was nothing to her. Talaria was always her home. I'm taking her to Talaria to be buried beside her mother.
No, Talaria too is lost. Every battle has casualties, Baron.
And I have become one of them.
All the anger gone from his voice, only dread clarity remained.
I have spent my life fighting battles I did not believe in, because I believed in you. No more. The cost is too high. Belief too rare. I've been a fool. I fought for things I did not love, and let what I loved slip away. First my wife, and then my daughter, and now myself. I'm taking Hannah back to Teleria. I'm fighting for my home, and her home, and my wife's grave. I'm finally going to fight a battle I believe in.
You cannot.
Goodbye, my friend.
Then he was gone, teleported to the desert above. It wasn't difficult for Baron to find his daughter's grave. He put a locator enchantment on her shortly after she'd been born. With it, he could find her anywhere. The Mage Master blasted away the sand surrounding her, and as he exhumed his daughter's body, Baron finally realized the full price of his faith in Urza. She was wrapped in a white shroud, and as Baron drew her into his arms, he saw the crew of Weatherlight through the curtain of dust. They had rushed to the gravesite when they saw the sandstorm begin. Tongarth stood nearest, his axe lifted to slay any beast that might emerge. Sisse and Orym stared in disbelief at the violated grave of their friend. Only Gerard, beyond them all, understood. He saw not the storm, but the man in the storm. He saw Baron's eyes and the guilt in them. He shared that guilt. Hannah had died while the two men she loved most were busy fighting Phyrexians. It was more than Baron could bear. With a nod to Gerard, he took Hannah away to Teleria. Baron teleported to Rain's unmarked grave on the coast of the island where he also interred his daughter. He intended to be buried there, in the protective sarcophagus he'd built for his wife, but it wasn't to be. Then he rose into the air for the last time. At the end of the Brothers' War, Urza had lost Mishra to Phyrexia. In his rage, he had unleashed a blast from an artifact called the Silex. That blast had sunk continents and reshaped Dominaria. It had also made Urza a veritable god. Baron was no god. He did not have a Silex. He did not wish to sink continents, but he knew the spell Urza had cast, and it would be enough. Above and around him, massive cruisers glided through the sky. Baron made no effort to cloak himself. A single man rising through a smoky sky was hard enough to see, and those massive machines were oblivious to so small a threat. As he ascended, he closed his eyes and drew upon the power of his fury. Lava, brimstone, fire, he thought of Shiv, of the mana rig pumping red-hot stone like a giant heart. Rage welled in him. He was its vessel. Hatred shaped the spell, but he needed more power. He drew mana from Teleria beneath him. He remembered Karin's birth in the first Teleria. He remembered the war with Krik in the second Teleria. He remembered Joyra and Teferi, Weatherlight and the Metathran, Rain and Hannah. As blue mana coursed into him, Baron tapped other lands, verdant Yavimea, militant Benalia, undead Urborg. He drew all the power into himself and became a living Silex. Beams shot from his eyes and fingertips and every extremity. Every wound ever struck on his body burst open and shone. His flesh could not contain the radiance. Soon, Baron glared like a second sun. Beams of power struck ships. They cut metal as though it were water. They turned Phyrexian armor to liquid metal and Phyrexian flesh to ash. Cruisers and plague ships spewed smoke through thousands of sudden holes. Engines went critical, and ship-to-ship destruction spread through the sky. As the sky burned, so too did the island below. Oceans boiled, trees flash burned, rocks melted. Whatever creatures had stood on Teleria were blinded by the flash and deafened by the concussion and dismantled by the raw power. Phyrexians, scholars, students, all died at that moment. Their struggles were done. Their bodies were gone. Even the ground on which they stood turned to wax and ran. Only Rain and Hannah were safe, sealed in their sarcophagi. How like Urza Baron had become. At last the blast spent itself, leaving a hole in the sky. No ships remained, no clouds, and the beaming sun seemed dim and gray. Cold waves crashed into boiling seas as water churned silt as red as blood. Where once had been a verdant island was now a molten slab of rock hissing into the sea. Teleria was gone, and so was her one-time lord, Mage Master Baron. For his family, Baron made a funeral pyre of Talaria. R.I.P. Baron.
Jeez. R.I.P. Talaria. Jeez.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Just wiped it off the face of the... I guess it's a planet.
Wiped it.
That's wild.
Let's, like, do that in a movie. That'd be boss. Okay, so, with Talaria lost and the Coalition forces massed at Koilos, Elodomri and Agnate led their Matathran army against the Phyrexians once again. They weren't alone, of course. They were joined by the Elves of Llanowar, the Benelish fleet, and Weatherlight. Their goal was the same, close the portal. The ground battle was somewhat of a distraction, for the real fight was led by Gerard Tongarth and 200 Benelish warriors that Weatherlight had dropped off at the mouth of the cave leading to the portal. Once that task was complete, Sisse took the airship back up and continued to supply air support to the Coalition forces. So, as Gerard's strike team entered the cave, Tabo Tavek was still dissecting Thaddeus with the help of several Vat priests, and at the same time sensed the invasion into her caves. She left the Metathran splayed on her operating table and scuttled from her deep cave to capture her prey. Agnate also fought on and would have continued to clear the ranks of Phyrexians surrounding the caves if it weren't for a mental communique from Thaddeus. He had thought his twin dead at the hands of Tabo Tavek, but instead Thaddeus begged him not to enter the caves, not to come to his aid. Agnate did the opposite, of course. He, with Elodomri's help, tore a path in the Phyrexian army and eventually reached the mouth of the caves. Then they entered with a swath of Metathran soldiers. By that point, Urza and his Titan engines had joined the fight. Surrounding the battlefield, they had charged at their enemies, at the last second leaping over the outlines of the Coalition forces and crushing hundreds of Phyrexians as they landed. Each Titan was given a slice of the battlefield to deal with, and Urza planned for them to meet in the middle at the caves. Tabo Tavek had a surprise in store for them, though. She called for more of her children hidden beneath the sand to rise. These creatures were ancient and massive, heedless, featureless. The enormous things consisted of a gigantic central body that bristled with quills. From their hunched and shaggy backs fell storms of sand. They rose on impossibly thin limbs, white and thousands like the tentacles of a jellyfish. But they didn't use the legs to stand on. The monsters could float. Or fly. They used the tentacles to tear ships from the skies and lift whole platoons to their fangy mouths.
Fangy.
Best of all, Tabo thought, they could regenerate as quickly as a wound was struck.
Oh boy.
They were called witch engines, and Weatherlight was, at first, more successful at dealing with them than Urza's Titan engines. That's what you should call your crew, the Witch Engine.
Witch Engines, yeah.
No, just call it the Witch Engine. Oh. Yeah. Okay. don't. I'll take care of this one. Roll. Okay. Ainsley's in pain. She went to a pump class.
Yeah.
Pump it up.
After confirming, what were you going to say, Riley?
Pump it up.
Yeah. Yeah, partway through, I thought I was going to puke it up. It was intense.
Puke it up.
Puke it up.
Well, the thing is, if you puke at the gym, they have to clean it up.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah,
but so. You don't want to be the one who pukes in class. You don't want to be the puker. But, you know, everyone's going to go home and be like, someone puked in class today.
Oh, of course they are, but you're giving them a good story. That's a gift.
Nobody. Puke is never a gift.
So if you're not the one that has to clean it up, puke is always a gift. Because you're giving someone a story.
I hate when other people barf.
I know, so you don't like it, but I hate it. You know, for most of us, it doesn't make, watching someone throw up doesn't make us feel like we need to throw up.
You know how, like, if you're going on a flight, like, some people get nervous, like, they're nervous about the plane crashing or whatever, right?
Those people don't have life insurance.
And my biggest fear about flying is that I'm going to be sitting next to a stranger who gets airsick.
I think that's a more reasonable fear.
Thanks, Riley.
Yeah.
It's very validating.
It definitely is a more reasonable fear than worrying about dying in a plane crash.
Yeah, you should be more worried about driving a car crash. Yeah. It's true.
But yeah, just what we can do is, if we're ever traveling together again on a plane, it's been a while.
It has.
You can have, like, the window seat or the aisle seat, and I'll sit in the middle.
That's kind. That's fucking love, guys.
Yeah. Because if someone's going to puke, I'll just start wailing on them and I'll knock them out so they don't puke.
That's right. That's not quite 10 years of love.
Thank you. Good callback.
It's like a 5 to 9 year relationship. Yeah.
We're in the 5 to 9 range.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So how long have you two been together? We're in the 5 to 9s right now. Yeah.
Not yet in the 10 to 15.
You know how it is. So after confirming that Weatherlight's plasma cannons could not truly harm a witch engine, Orym, Karn, and Multani used the ship's anchor to catch one, much the same way Orym had caught Phyrexians back on Wrath. That was in part two. Mm. Once snagged on the beast's central body, Karn increased speed and the anchor tore the witch engine in half. Without its central body intact, it could not regenerate, much like the mutant Wolverine.
Huh.
Well, I mean, like Wolverine could still... regenerate.
Right, for Wolverine it was the head. I think if like you cut off his head, I don't think he could regenerate a whole body. Maybe like Deadpool could do it because I think his regenerative powers were a little bit more robust. But we're going to see them in a movie together.
There you go.
Which is fun.
Abra's ear is gently touching the mic. So yeah, if you hear anything. If you hear
it's this thick boy.
He's a thick boy.
Taking the lead from Weatherlight, the Titan engines tore their new foes in half, mopping up what was left of the Phyrexian army and advancing to the mouth of the caves. By that point, Agnate had discovered the cave that held Thaddeus. He was horrified at the state of his twin. Thaddeus was spiked to a slated table. His limbs were gone, flayed away tissue by tissue. All of it was stored in solution jars on shelves behind him. I just like finished watching Dahmer not that long ago, and this is kind of giving me Dahmer vibes. They had cut away his pelvis too, and his spine, bone by bone, up the lumbar curve. Abdominal organs occupied various silver trays. Pins jutted from them. That priest lay in bloody ruin beneath the samples, because Agnate had dispatched them. Only Thaddeus's rib cage and head remained. The aorta had been expertly sutured, allowing his heart to maintain pressure through the man's upper body. A large round rock had been leaned against the diaphragm to press the muscle up toward the lungs. He breathed through a scabby stoma in his throat. His eyes, in utter despair, watched Agnate approach. Thaddeus could no longer speak and had to communicate with Agnate telepathically. He insisted that he was done for, but Agnate resolved to rescue him. Take him back to Talaria, where Urza could build him a new body. Which we know can't happen.
I have like a vision of him like, he has like a little satchel or something. He's like, okay, I'm going to put your liver in here and like your guts in here. Don't worry, I'm going to get you.
He's like, good thing, buddy, I brought a box of Ziplocs.
Never leave home without
him. But even as he pleaded with Thaddeus, he knew what he had to do. As Agnate looked into his twin's eyes, his sword fell, killing him, and Thaddeus was free. Then Agnate folded to his knees and buried his face in his hands.
Oh, fuck, this is a rough one.
This is a tough episode. Yeah. Although Baron went out like a boss.
Yeah.
Out like a light.
Yeah. It was sad, but it was like, That's really cool. Well, I especially
Katy Perry's Firework was playing in the background.
I should put that in. Yeah. But what's really cool is like when all of his wounds open up, and again, like Wolverine at the end of the first X-Men movie, when he's like saving Rogue and all of his wounds open up.
Yeah.
I think that's just a good storytelling device. It's just like, wow, it's rough.
You've had some wounds.
Yeah, I got hashtag wound.
Hashtag moon life. Hashtag blessed.
So by that point, Gerard, Tongarth, and what was left of their strike force had almost reached the portal, and Tabo Tavik had almost reached Gerard. The battle was pretty much won topside, so Weatherlight landed near the cave entrance where Karn, Sisse, Orym, and Squee disembarked and went in to help Gerard and Tongarth. As Gerard and Tongarth advanced on the portal cave, they were momentarily separated, and that's when Tabo Tavik struck. Gerard fought her as best he could, but quickly found himself in her grasp. As Gerard writhed with hatred and fury, she hissed,
"You think you can stop me?"
"I think I can kill you."
Such delicious hatred. You will make a fine Phyrexian.
And she probably like licked his face, I imagine. Yeah, she's like blah, blah, beard blah. Hairs. Yeah, like blah, blah. Then Gerard plunged his sword all the way into her abdomen. She held him with three of her eight legs, and the wound covered Gerard in oil blood. Then he felt a sudden and sharp pain in his back. Something gored him. It punched into his spine and poured out hot, hissing substance. Glistening oil flooded his body, and he was suddenly experiencing reality as one of Tabo Tavik's children. So she'd like poked him with her stinger. That's what that is. Her prize under control, she scuttled to the portal cave, to Phyrexia, to bring Yawgmoth his prize.
Yawgmoth daddy.
Karn, Sisse, Orym, and Squee followed the path of destruction carved out by the Benelish Brigade. It led them to a vast, deep chamber. There, Elidomri and his Metathran troops had joined Tongarth and the Benelish forces. Together, they battled a horde of Phyrexians, while more spilled from the shimmering portal on the far side of the cave. Beside the portal, surrounded by hundreds of Phyrexians, was the mirror pedestal. On it rested a giant book of glass and metal. Lines of power radiated from it, coursing into the portal. They had two priorities, find Gerard and close the portal. Gerard was nowhere to be seen in the cave, so they focused on the latter. But as the coalition fought to reach the pedestal, they saw Tabo Tavik enter the cave carrying Gerard. Weatherlight's crew quickly changed tactics and attacked the Spider Woman. Tongarth and Sisse posed a threat, but in the end, they were cast aside like ragdolls. It seemed that at that point, there was no one to stop her. Not even Elidomri could fight past the mass of monsters to the portal's entrance. But just as Tabo Tavik was about to make her exit, she was jerked to a sudden stop. One leg seemed caught. Karn rose, magnificent, from beneath a mound of clawing Phyrexians, which seemed no more than insects sloughing off his massive shoulders. He clutched the Spider Woman's leg in one massive hand and grabbed another with his other hand. With one strong heave, the Silver Man yanked one of her legs from its sockets, spilling sparks and oil blood on the already soaked cave floor. Then he grabbed another leg and yanked it free. Tabo had to use one of the legs holding Gerard to steady herself as she tried to free herself from Karn's grasp. But the Silver Man was implacable. Implacable? The Silver Man was implacable. Above the cacophony of battle, his voice rang out.
No more. If I must kill the guilty to save the innocent, I will kill.
He's not a pacifist no more. Then he ripped another one of her legs from its socket. But before he could get another handhold, Tabo leapt away and skittered to the shimmering portal. It seemed that she had won this round. But as happened so often, she underestimated Weatherlight's crew, specifically Squee. The goblin had scurried, unnoticed, up to the portal and under the Spider Woman and handed Gerard a sword. By that point, Gerard had awoken from his glistening oil-induced fever dream and gladly took the blade from Squee. He thrust the blade into the previous wound he dealt to Tabo. Crippled by the wound and the loss of so many legs, released Gerard, and he fell on the glass book holding the portal open. Then the portal slammed shut, trapping Tabo Tavik on Dominaria. Gerard scrambled off the giant book, swinging his sword in front of him to attack the Spider Woman, and the portal reappeared. Realizing too late what he'd done, Gerard lunged for the book as Tabo dove through the open portal. Gerard doubled back and landed on the book once again, slamming the portal shut. All that was left on the Dominarian side was one of her arms and one of her cheeks. It's a face cheek.
Oh, I was going to ask. Thanks for clarifying.
The rest of her made it to Phyrexia in one piece. The Spider Woman had escaped, but the Coalition had won the Battle of Koilos. All that was left to do was mop up what was left of the Phyrexians in the cave, which was easy without their mother commanding them. Once their task was complete, the Blind Seer appeared in front of Gerard and revealed his true identity, which we know is Urza. Urza explained that he'd created Karn, the legacy, even Gerard himself. Gerard didn't at first believe the old man, but Urza replied,
I am the one who started all this. I am the beginning. You are the end. I have made you and your legacy for this very hour. I have watched you fight, Gerard. I have seen you command your ship, your crew. You have been everything I imagined and more. The result is this: victory at Koilos.
You are the beginning, and I'm the end?
I first opened this portal by removing the power stone that closed it. Even now, the two halves of that stone reside here, in my skull. They have made me what I am. I have made you what you are, my opposite, my complement, my counterpart. Just as the stones that once opened this portal are part of my being, so your very being has the power to close it.
Then Urza reached into his shimmering robes and withdrew a mighty sword. Gerard rose from the book and drew his sword, and the two men brought their weapons down on the glass book, destroying it and closing the portal forever. As they left the cave, Gerard inquired about his creation again.
You made me for this? You created my legacy? Plotted my destiny?
I did, Gerard Capuchin.
I hate you.
I hate you.
I mean it. I really do hate you. It wasn't the Phyrexians who took everything from me. It was you. From the beginning of my life, you have destined me to lose everything.
If you fulfill your destiny, in losing all, you will gain all.
No, you're wrong. I will be your champion, your hero, yes. I will fight the fight I am destined to, but all the while, I will hate you.
I know. I will count it as one of my own great losses.
I hate you. And in that moment,
I hate you, Papa.
I don't want your life. And in that moment, Urza did not seem the great, ancient, and powerful planeswalker, but rather an old and lonely man. But it's difficult to be too hard on him. He'd lost everything more than once in his long life. But he was right. Koilos was a victory, and over the following week, the caves and surrounding desert were cleansed of Phyrexia and its minions. That last week was followed by a three-day festival celebrating the coalition victory over not just Koilos, but also Llanowar, Yavimea, and to a lesser degree, Zalfir and Shiv. Urza didn't agree with Teferi's methods, but he was true to his word. He had protected his people. The morning after the festival was quiet, with only a handful of guards awake, them and the green man from Yavimea. Multani heard a sound, a strange rumble. There was movement in the desert, vast movement. He rose through the timbers of Weatherlight and assembled a body for himself out of the living splinters and shards of wood he found along the way. On deck, the pieces piled themselves into legs, a torso, arms, and a head. Two knot holes made themselves into eyes. With them, Multani studied the landscape. Strange, twisted shapes were imposing themselves on the sands of Koilos, hills like flayed muscle, fields of tortured red. Across those lands were arrayed enormous Phyrexian armies. It didn't seem quite real, the coruscating red world, but the tangled land seemed so solid, so alive. Multani had seen a world like that once before. He had glimpsed it in the mind of a dead Phyrexian in Yavimea. The monster had a name for the world that was at that moment slowly overlaying itself on Dominaria. Wrath.
Ooh.
And that's invasion.
Ooh.
So next up, we'll be covering Plane Ship, which is part two of the invasion cycle, and it centers around the next stage of the Phyrexian invasion, which is, of course, the Wrathy overlay, which we've discussed previously. And hope everyone enjoyed this this very somber episode and this series as a whole. Riley and Ainsley, thank you for your fantastic voice performances.
Thanks for the memories.
R.I.P. Hannah and Baron.
Jesus.
We'll miss you. Baron went out like a boss.
He did.
Like a bomb.
Yeah, got to, you know? Yeah. Well, when you got nothing left, you know, just burn it all down. Yeah. We'll be back pretty soon with Plane Shift. And we're looking forward to wrapping up this series. I feel like this is like the end of the whole like Urza
era
saga thing. And his whole legacy and everything. So I'm looking forward to getting into it, because I haven't read like Plane Shift or Apocalypse, which is the book after that, which doesn't, you know, the name of that book really doesn't bode well for the characters here. Mm-hmm. But we'll be back soon with another episode. Thank you all for listening, and just take it easy out there.
Yeah, you better.
You better fucking take it easy or Riley's gonna get ya.
He'll check.
He'll check. He's gonna check up on ya, yeah. Just like Santa.
He's got a list.
Forgotten Lore.